The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com. The Eric Metaxas Show with your host, Eric Metaxas.
Hey, folks, it's Friday. And you know that on the Eric Metaxas Show on Friday, we get a little crazy.
We do.
Oh, it's going to get crazy. Are you ready?
Oh, boy.
Albin, what do we have for the people?
Well, I'm still, as you know, there's the pirate pandemic. I am wearing my eye patch, so I am ready for the pirate.
Okay, now we've got a lot of pirate pandemic comedy coming up, folks. But before that, I want to warn you. We did a long interview with Pat Boone the other day. We couldn't run the rest of it. So today, in the next segment and the segments following, we're running the rest of that interview. It is amazing. Pat Boone is just one of these amazing, true legends. So stay tuned for that. After Pat Boone, we're going to rerun something that we did yesterday,
yes,
which is more pirate pandemic comedy. But right now, Albin.
Yes, sir.
What do we want to do? I've noticed that you're wearing this eye patch.
Yes.
But I was told that we have a guest during this segment who is a friend of yours who's also wearing an eye patch.
Yeah, he's pretty much a friend of mine, sure.
And
yeah.
Who is that? Can we see who that is?
Oh, look at that.
Whoa.
Is that?
Yeah.
I'm seeing double.
Well, you're seeing it stereo, that's for sure.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait a minute. You look just like Albin, only better looking. Who are you, sir?
Well, I'm Tony. I'm Albin's identical twin brother here. And
are you younger or older?
I heard about this pirate. No, he's 5 minutes older, I was told.
So you're younger. And you obviously bring the glow of youth to what is Albin's desiccated body. So to be able to see the young version of Albin is astonishing. But you, sir, so Albin, you're named Albin, and your twin brother is Tony.
Yes.
Okay, Tony, you're in Pittsburgh. You still live in the home country there?
Well, I've actually ended up here in a hotel room somewhere in New York. I'm kind of quarantined because I, heard about this new pandemic, the pirate pandemic.
Yeah.
It came from the Caribbean. Came from the Caribbean.
From a sick parrot, apparently, yeah. But what's that?
I hope it's not my pet parrot because I've been always wondering about this guy has been. I thought it was just whooping cough.
Now, by the way, this is a good teaching moment for the audience.
Yes.
Folks, if you're listening on radio, you're missing the hilarity. You have no idea.
Okay.
I'm telling you, go to ericmetaxas.com, sign up for the newsletters because you want to see the video. What I'm looking at right now is insane. We've got Albin in the studio and his brother, his twin, also wearing an eye patch, but you guys, you call it the pirate pandemic, but you're from Pittsburgh where the pirates play.
Yeah.
So now I'm confused.
Yeah. A little suspicious there.
Yeah. I just want to mention again, it's from the Caribbean, okay, or Caribbean, however you want to. It was a feather market down there, a sick parrot, apparently. Now, some people are saying it was an unsanitized beer tap or something at PNC Park, but, I'm not going there. I'm from Pittsburgh. I'm not going to cast aspersions on
our city.
So,
but the bottom line is this new virus, because there's new variations.
Yes.
And this new variation, forget about the old variations, the new variation, it enters through the right eye.
The right eye, yes.
And that's why you guys are wearing patches.
Yes.
Because of your love for your fellow man, you don't want to spread the virus.
No,
the pirate pandemic virus.
Yeah. If we could save just one life in the 8 billion of the planet, we should all wear this eye patch when commanded by.
I just love the fact that you twins, that you that you boys are such cut-ups that you want to do this together. It just means so much to me to see. I wish I could have a twin. Can I still get a twin?
Well, you can have mine when I'm done with them.
Is that right?
Yeah. Okay.
The way you treat your younger brother, that's not right.
But one of the reasons, and I told Eric about this, Anthony, you were with Senator Doug Mastriano on Sunday. He was doing...
On Sunday.
Okay, let's be clear. Mastriano is a hero. He is a state senator in Pennsylvania, where you, Tony, currently reside, and you guys are from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Absolutely.
You were with Mastriano the other day.
Yeah.
And has anybody ever told you you look like Albin?
You know what? He noticed
it's freaking
that.
Me out.
He noticed that right away.
I've said this, you have the glow of youth.
Thank you.
Yeah.
You have said that.
Your patch is a little askew, but we're going to let you go because you're on radio.
Well, okay. I figured I'm isolated right now.
We're confusing my audience, and that's my goal. Listen, folks, let's get serious. No kidding. Tony, let's forget about the fact that you're Albin's twin. You were with Doug Mastriano, who is leading the charge in Pennsylvania to get the votes counted. So what do we need to know about what is going on? Because, look, folks, I hate to get serious, but the whole nation rests on what is happening in a couple of places. Probably the most prominent at this point is Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. So what did you find out, Tony?
Well, it was a true the vote kind of a rally with Doug Mastriano and several women who are putting together audit the vote PA.com.
Audit the vote PA.com.
And Susanna DeGeet, who put this together. I don't know if you can see
this. Patriots for Action. Right.
Yeah, with the four as in the number. PatriotsForAction.com.
Right.
And it's they want the elected constitutional patriots to pass laws to secure election integrity.
Wait, all across the country.
All over the country.
Okay, we got to be clear. PatriotsForAction.com, the number four. PatriotsForAction.com. Patriots for, the number four. PatriotsForAction.com. Susanna DeGeet is heading that up. And they want to do this all across the country. We've got to help them, folks. This is so important. Gosh.
It's the idea of letting legislators work for us. You know, actually, but put them, you know, let's audit the vote. If things were correctly done, let's put it, lay our cards on the table. Like,
we're not saying that stealing is wrong.
No,
we're not saying that.
And
God says that.
And I want to point something out. I might be a big radio star, right?
Oh yeah.
But a regular guy like my twin brother there in Pennsylvania,
right.
he's just a regular guy, he's doing his part.
The fact
right?
that a big nobody,
like
Tony, whoever heard of Tony, you know, Sadar, that he would step up to the plate as though he were somebody and do stuff.
Yeah.
It is unbelievable. If a loser, let me just be clear to my audience, if a loser like Tony could do a thing like this, forget about Albin.
Right.
What? Wow. What are Americans capable of doing? Ladies and gentlemen, if Tony can do it, so can you. So go to PatriotsForAction.com. Use the number four, PatriotsForAction.com. Tony, you're a stand-up guy.
Yeah, and you know what else I like about my twin brother? If you'll notice, if you're watching on Rumble or if you got the newsletter and all that, he took off his eye patch because he wanted to show his independence. And I just did it now myself because of a young buck like my twin brother down there in Pennsylvania. He could take it off. As a big star, I'm going to take it off. He's showing us big guys.
I wonder how many listeners we lost today.
Well, about five, and that's now we're down to just one more. But you know,
it's so chaotic.
Yeah.
It's so chaotic. But the beauty is nobody cares. No, Tony, really, I love seeing you because you look just like your brother, only younger. It's incredible. The bloom of youth, it's freaking me out. It's freaking me out.
Yeah.
How you're just 5 minutes younger, but you look dozens of minutes younger.
And I got to pinch my cheeks to bring the rose back there. But he's got it naturally.
How long have you two been twins?
Like 5 minutes after I was born, I'm going
to
say.
I need to get the calculator.
I think you're twins even in the womb, probably.
We could have been.
Don't you think?
He kicked a lot, but I kicked back, okay? Just so you know, folks.
But it really is. It's a beautiful thing that you're still almost friends after all these years of harsh sibling twin rivalry.
Yeah.
That the bitterness, you're willing to put that aside to heal the nation.
Yes. Thank you. Like the fact that my twin brother uses the code Eric when he goes to Nutramedics.com until midnight tonight. It's 30% off.
That's not a joke, folks.
No.
Literally, today is the last day, midnight Friday Eastern time. You can get 30% off. Otherwise, it's 20% off when you use the code Eric. They just did this as a special way to bless us because we were knocked off of YouTube.
And because I have
advantage.
A twin. Because I have a twin. So
and because of the twin.
Yeah.
So please go to Nutramedics.com. Use the code Eric before midnight tonight and you get 30% off. I'm afraid we're out of time. Just think of the eye patch twin comedy that we're missing by having to end this segment. Ladies and gentlemen, I apologize. Thank you.
And slap some mud on the wall. The roof is leaking like a strainer. There's loads of roaches in the hall. Speedy Gonzales.
Hey there, folks. How many years have I been telling you about Relief Factor? What, like four? The truth is, I know there are millions of people. In fact, some say over 100 million people struggling with some kind of pain, maybe from exercise, just getting older. That could do it, getting older, which is why I am so impressed with Pete and Seth Talbot. They are on a mission. You rarely see this kind of focus and commitment. Seriously, they recently shared with me that they are doubling down and want to literally double their total number of happy customers in the next year. And I believe they'll do it. So here's the deal. If you're struggling with back, neck, shoulder, hip, or knee pain, even general muscle aches and pains, then I'm suggesting you order their 3-week quick start, still discounted to only $19.95, about a dollar a day to see if we can get you out of pain too. And then after that, less than the cost of a cup of coffee a day to stay out of pain. Go to relieffactor.com, relieffactor.com, or call 800-500-8384, relieffactor.com, 800-500-8384. I use it. It works. Check it out.
Hey there, folks. Yes, yes, it's the Eric Metaxas Show, and I'm talking to Pat Boone. And the shocker, he's talking back to me. Pat Boone, we were just talking about some crazy stuff. So you were friendly with, like, everybody. It's getting ridiculous. So I want to need a list of people that you didn't know. That'll save us time in the future because you knew everybody else. So I just want to list people that you were not friendly with. We're talking about Frank Sinatra. We're talking about Bing Crosby. Now, I find it a little confusing that you said Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra, who were the crooners, they didn't like black music, race music, rhythm and blues. They didn't really get into that. But the reason I find that confusing is that Bing Crosby, you know, he performed stuff that the Mills Brothers were doing.
Yeah.
He performed when he had a TV program. He had the Mills Brothers on his program.
Right.
He was a jazz enthusiast. He was doing scat and all this stuff. So he was in the world of quote-unquote black music, unless jazz was not considered black music and rhythm and blues. You know, it gets silly. But why do you think that he would take that view of what you're doing when he himself was very well known in that world?
I'm so glad you gave me a chance to give a little more context to the remarks they made because – yes, Bing and Satchmo were very close.
Yeah,
and many and the Mills Brothers, and before that the Ink Spots. And Bing actually tried to scat and did scat with Ella Fitzgerald and.
That's what I'm saying. Anybody who's a student of 20th century music knows that he was in that world. And you say Satchmo, in case anybody doesn't know, we're talking about Louis Armstrong. It doesn't get more central and seminal than Louis Armstrong when you're talking about 20th century American jazz. So,
Bing, the same way, but Bing said that he thought Satchmo, he had on his own radio show a number of times and Up the Lazy River and great songs like that. And he said he thought Satchmo was the best musician in the country, singer and trumpet player and just all around musician. And he really, I think, Satchmo would have credited Bing with the rise and the very big success of his career, which might have happened anyway, but Bing opened the door gladly Now, Frank was the same with all the black performers he performed. It was the music that we call rock and roll. It was the sort of down and dirty blues and some of the subject matter of rock and roll. Rock and roll, the name, was that those words were not referring to dancing in the R&B music. It was that we're going to rock and roll, mama, all night long. And but when Bill Haley and the Comets sang rock Around the Clock, it became dancing. And yeah, you can dance all night too, but some of the lyrics in some of the R&B songs that were big hits were more than erotic. They were, you know, pretty open. Like even one of the songs I did, and I hate to confess this, but I might as well. One of my Little Richard songs that I covered was Long Tall Sally. Now, Long Tall Sally is never explained by Little Richard in the song who Long Tall Sally was, but she's long and tall. Nobody cares if she's long and tall. But saw Uncle John with Long Tall Sally. He saw Aunt Mary coming, and he ducked back in the alley. I mean, I sang that lyric. But now the kids didn't know what in the world that was. And for that matter, I feigned innocence myself. And because it was a big rock and roll hit called Long Tall Sally, it became a million seller for me and for Little Richard, who wrote it, as did Rip It Up and Tutti Frutti.
And let's not forget that the Beatles covered Long Tall Sally.
You know, there's those references in those songs that Bing Crosby was never going to sing. Frank Sinatra was never going to sing those songs. I mean, there were erotic references, but much more sophisticated in Frank's singing and never in Bing's. Bing was known not to even want to sing the words I love you because it seemed too intimate. He did a time or two, but because he had to, those were the lyrics of the songs. But he liked songs that were more oblique, like Moonlight Becomes You, and those songs that were romantic, but not so specific. But the lyrics of what was becoming rock and roll. See, there was no rock and roll till I came along on the bicusp, but just the cusp, I should say, not the bicusp, but the cusp between rhythm and blues and rock and roll. And it became, in pop world, rock and roll, where before it was all just rhythm and blues and called race music. So for me, a white kid from Nashville, to be singing all these R&B songs eventually prompted Jesse Jackson about 4 years ago to say on the Rainbow Coalition station in Chicago that he thought Pat Boone did more for race relations with my music than any other singer, because I was making black music, race music, rhythm and blues, known and popular to white audiences. We called it rock and roll, but they were the same songs. Ain't That a Shame, Tutti Frutti, Rip It Up, Long Tall Sally, I Almost Lost My Mind, all these songs. And he said, I think, this was Jesse Jackson, that Pat Boone, white kid, not only singing the songs and having hits with them, but bringing the original performers like Little Richard and Fats on his TV show and singing with them, that I was making all of this music okay to parents and the performers themselves, the original performers themselves, okay as well. Now, that was not intentional on my part, I have to confess. I was just singing the songs which were put in front of me to sing, and I liked them and I sang them. I would sanitize some of the lyrics. Like in Tutti Frutti, Richard, his words were, boy, you don't know what she do to me. And I changed it to Pretty Little Susie is the girl for me. Well, the kids didn't care. They didn't know what the original words were, and they wouldn't have cared for that either. But I was trying to be, as an English major at Columbia University and also a Christian guy, trying to make all these lyrics acceptable to what I knew was a large white audience. But the interesting thing for me is that I was accepted on the rhythm and blues charts, which were black charts, and I was accepted as a rhythm and blues singer. My version of Ain't That a Shame, which Fats Domino went to number one with in the rhythm and blues field and sold 150,000, which was big. I recorded his song. It went pop, rock, and roll and sold 1.5 million. 10 times what his had sold. And he admittedly, happily, I made more money from Pat Boone's record of my song than I did from my own.
Finish what you're saying, but I have to ask you a question related to all this. It's killing me.
Okay, this is a good place. I mean, I was accepted on the R&B charts as a rhythm and blues singer, along with the black performers. I was accepted as a rhythm and blues singer, several records on their charts, because I was singing their songs.
Okay, well, this leads to the question, how in the world is it possible that you have not been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame? It makes no sense. You are as central to the development and introduction of rock and roll into the world, certainly into America, as anyone alive. How is it possible that they have not yet inducted you? I don't get it.
It's very simple. My lifestyle, who I am as a person and what people knew about me. I don't fit Jan Wenner, the publisher of the Rolling Stone and the guy who created the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and his buddies. I don't fit their image of a rock and roll singer. And of course, I committed the cardinal sins during the 50s while I was recording my rock and roll hits that were on the R&B charts as well as the pop charts. I also recorded the first million-selling hymn album, and I also recorded a lot of movie themes and ballads.
Well, now, wait a minute. Elvis Presley recorded more than one album of hymns, yeah, of
later
Jesus music. So,
yeah. His was posthumous. He recorded gospel songs, and he actually got Grammys, not nominations, but Grammys for his gospel albums after he was gone.
Wait a minute. After he died, after 1977, he got this stuff? So he was not. I could have sworn that he recorded albums in the 60s that were gospel albums.
Well, if they did, they weren't nominated for Grammys. All I know is that I was the first million-selling hymn album called Hymns We Love in like 57 or 8, and Elvis was recording.
And Jan Wenner has a problem with that? I'm going to visit Jan Wenner at the Rolling Stone offices. I'm going to give him a piece of my mind. And it's bizarre. I think if only you'd had a period where you were strung out on heroin, or maybe just, you know, hit some people with a lamp in a hotel room, anything just to help you with Jan Wenner so that you could get, not that you care whether you're inducted, but it's just the strangest thing I've ever heard. We're going to go to another break, folks. Yes, I'm talking to Pat Boone. We'll be right back.
Be faithful, darling, while you're away. For when it's time,
I'm talking to Pat Boone. You heard me. Pat Boone, the Pat Boone. At least he claims to be the Pat Boone. Pat Boone, I still can't get over the fact that you're not in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Anybody who knows your history in the music business, it's preposterous. Look, you're 87. You don't act like you're 87, but the fact is you're 87. So you can't say, you know what, to get in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, I'm going to get strung out on heroin. I'm going to go through a season of heroin abuse. I'll come out of it, and then they'll say, yes, now you're ready. You can't do that. So they need to grandfather you in. But it doesn't make sense. Let's just talk about your hits. How many songs charted? How many number ones? That alone, it seems to me, would put you light years ahead of half of the people who have already been inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Well, yeah, by what you might call by rights, by record sales, numbers, chart appearances, the songs themselves weren't just covers of current rhythm and blues songs. I went back and recorded songs picked by Randy Wood of Dot Records, of course, by Ivory Joe Hunter and other former R&B greats who weren't popular or weren't doing so great at the time, but I would record one of their former hits in my way, and it furthered the parade of R&B songs that were known as race music, black music.
So just by doing that, you'd completely change the world of music, for good or for ill. I mean, if I'm interested in rock and roll, that's the story of rock and roll. Some white guy named Pat Boone records these songs, opens the door, completely changes the popularity of that kind of music. That's the history of rock and roll. It's inevitable. There's no way you get there without what you did. So let me just ask you, go ahead.
Somebody would have done it. I must say, I can't take full credit.
I can give you credit.
Other people were starting to pick up. And, of course, Elvis, his song Hound Dog had already been an R&B hit. We both recorded Good Rockin' Tonight, which has already been an R&B hit. We both covered R&B songs, which was nothing wrong with it. The R&B artists loved it because it not only was more royalties to them because they wrote the songs, but also in many cases, in my case, particularly with Little Richard and Fats, it brought them over from being just black or R&B artists into the white, more white than black, rock and roll market. And they credited me with that. I mean, Fats and Little Richard on record were saying, you know, Pat Boone opened the door for us to that bigger audience. Even Chuck Berry on his documentary said, you know, I was recording blues and I wanted to get to the teens like Pat Boone. He actually mentioned I wanted to get to the teens. That's when he wrote Maybelline and Sweet Little 16 and Memphis and those songs and got on the charts like I was and like Fats and Little Richard were when they recorded these songs and got them into the now burgeoning rock and roll market. So you can pick who the authority to listen to, either Jan Winter, who said I was never really rock and roll, and my versions of those songs were vanilla and watered down versions, which they were not. But or you can listen to Jesse Jackson, who lived through the era and said, I think Pat Boone did more for race relations with his music than any other singer. Somebody else would have done it if it weren't me. In fact, other singers were coming along recording R&B songs just like I was. It happened that I was having more number one hits. So when Elvis started doing the same thing, he too had number one hits with Hound Dog and these other songs that had already been R&B hits.
Speaking of white people who took these songs and made them popular, the Beatles, their first, you know, several albums, it's stuff like this Long Tall Sally and Chuck Berry stuff. So I should ask you, did you ever meet any of the Beatles?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, sure. They
did they open for you, too?
No, but I went into business with them. When they got hit so big, I mean, I was in England when their first record was a hit. If there's anything that you want, if there's anything I can do, just call on me
and I'll send it along with love.
From me to you. I love that record, and I brought it home and asked Randy Wood at Dot Records if I could record it. And he said, no, it's already been out on a label here in America, on another label called VJ Records, who's by the way, the head of that company was also named Randy Wood. Randy Wood of Dot Records said, no, that record has already been out. It wasn't a hit by the Beatles. Well, it got picked up by who became Capitol or whoever became the big Beatle. Because it had been released and it was not a hit originally in America. And Randy wouldn't let me record it. So, of course, the Beatles became astonishingly huge. And they took over the record business for a while. And all of us, Tom Jones and I and many others, were having to just take a back seat. And Elvis, because they... At one time, the Beatles had six singles in the top 10. So what was I going to do? I was, I was expecting record royalties because the record I hold in the record business is 220 consecutive weeks without ever being off the single chart. That's over 4 years. The Elton John did 157 weeks, I think, and then he for 1 week or another was off, and then he...
Wait a minute. You beat Elton John? Elton John has... All right, when we come back, We're going to dig into this, folks, and I'm going to need to see some documentation. I can't just take your word for it, Pat, just because we're friends. We're going to be right back talking to Pat Boone. In the sand.
How you laughed when I... Boom, 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 boom. Why, baby, why don't you treat me like you used to do?
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Eric. I'm talking to Pat. Pat, we're talking about the Beatles. You were just sharing, and then I want to move over to Woody Allen and Don Rickles and Johnny Carson, you know, just to name a few people. And then I want to talk about the Bible and the Lord of Hosts, if you can do that. So let's see. You were talking about going into business somehow with the Beatles. You said Tom Jones and Elvis and you had to take a back seat because the Beatles are roaring ahead. You should have done some LSD, and you should have hung out with the Maharishi Mahesh Yogi to really goose your career, but you didn't do that. So what did you do?
Well, I looked and saw that my record royalties were diminishing, and so I got a painter. I was already supporting a painter from Holland. That's another whole story. Who was a very good portrait painter. And I thought he was so good that when he asked if I would help him come to America and get launched here, I did. And he painted pictures, portraits of many stars, and I would introduce him to the stars. Of course, they wanted to buy their portraits and got him launched. So when the Beatles happened so big, I had him paint pictures individually of each of the Beatles and then a group portrait. And I got a fellow who had the know-how, the business know-how, to get to Sears. And we put all these Beatle pictures. And first I had to go to Brian Epstein, who was the business manager, the manager for the Beatles. And I had to sign a contract, get an actual contract, because he loved the pictures. They're portraits. They're beautiful portraits of each of them separately and a group portrait. And I got the license. And through this fellow named Goodwin Lyon, got him into Sears in packages, and we sold millions of Beatle pictures. And in that 1 year, I made more money selling Beatle pictures than I was making from my record royalties, which they had eclipsed. And I was in business with them. So when they came to Thomas Mack Arena, their first tour, and they were appearing in Las Vegas, my wife and I and my four daughters were on the front row of their afternoon performance in the theater, which was jammed to the rafters with screaming teenagers, and we were right on the front row. And I have pictures of that occasion, looking past Ringo at the drums and past the three guys on stage and at Shirley, me and the girls on the front row of their concert. And so the screams were deafening. I mean, I'd heard screams in my concerts, but nothing like this. We're nonstop. You could hardly hear them singing.
Well, that's why they stopped performing, right? I mean, it got to be ridiculous.
They were drowned out. And so anyway, we went backstage afterwards and we visited with the Beatles. And they told me, Paul said that they really loved those pictures. And he said, you know, most of what Brian's got us, you know, out there endorsing is crap. He said, but we love these pictures. They make us look good individually. Oil portraits and the group picture. And so they had sent somebody out to go to camera stores and buy cameras because they wanted to buy cameras. And this was their first tour. They wanted to take pictures of all that was happening around them. And so they were looking at cameras, but my daughter Laurie sat in Ringo's lap and Cherry was talking to me and Paul, and Lindy was talking to George, and that's who am I leaving? John, I guess Debbie was talking to John. And we all had a great, and Shirley was, of course, there talking with all of us. And then we went back out. We didn't stay for the second show because it was so deafening and we'd seen and heard all we came for. But we were very friendly. They were very complimentary. When I went eventually to the cave in Liverpool on a concert tour of my own, I went over to the cave where they first began, their career first took off, and there on the wall are the pictures that I had painting. They're on display at the cave that I had painted by a guy named Leo Jansen. And so I was woven into their lives and their career, and have had, you know, a warm correspondence relationship with Paul. I missed him once in a Ralph's Market out here in the, he had just left Ralph's Market out in the valley, we would have renewed our acquaintance in Ralph's Market.
Well, I'll tell him you say hello. I think he may live in my neighborhood. I saw him one day when I was running, and I just about bumped into him, and I said, you know, you really can't do that to people, I said to him. And he says, I didn't do it to you. You did it to me. And then I asked him if I could get a selfie. He says, no, I don't do selfies. And he was in the building, and I thought, you're dead to me, Sir Paul. Dead. Do you understand? But it's just crazy to me to think that you knew them back when, that you've stayed in touch with them. Now, people can't get these Jansen paintings anymore, I assume.
No, they're not. In fact, I did save a couple of packages of the originals, and you can see them on the, and I think I display them on my YouTube page or patboone.com. But no, I mean, we'd have to have more printed. But
you've got mail.
Hello.
Who's got mail? But so you're telling us stuff. It's just fascinating to me because, again, most of us, you know, don't live the kind of a life that you've been privileged to live. And it's amazing. I want to keep talking to you because there's just a lot more to say. But what's that? Yeah, Woody Allen. Let's touch on that if we can. Go ahead.
You mentioned him, and Woody was a writer on my Pat Boone Chevy show, an apprentice. He was serving an apprenticeship. He was appearing in Greenwich Village, a stand-up comedian, and the head writer on the show then was Larry Gelbart.
MASH.
Who eventually became the head writer on MASH, but back then he was available to be the head writer on a musical variety show. So Harry Gelbart was writer on my show, and he'd seen some of the stand-up by this quirky comedian in Greenwich Village, Woody Allen. So he made him and brought him in as an apprentice to two or three of the other writers who were much more known professionally. And Woody
I thought that Woody had already written for the show of shows by the time you had a show on, or maybe I'm getting it mixed up.
No, not yet. No, this was his first writing job.
Are you kidding? You gave Woody Allen his first writing job? Ladies and gentlemen, are you writing this down? Because nobody would believe it. When we come back, we'll just keep talking, Pat. There's so much. But folks, stick around. I'm talking to Pat Boone. Thank you.
To hold you tight, darling, don't forbid me to hold you tight. Let me hold you in my love.
Folks, I'm still talking to Pat Boone, and he's still, this is the miracle, talking to me. Okay, Pat, you talked about Woody Allen. Talk about the Manson family. Tex Watson was one of the Manson disciples, one part of the family. Horrible stuff. Why did you want to bring them up?
It's really odd to mention that in the same breath almost as Woody Allen, who was a writer on my TV show, which he never mentions in his resume, by the way. I've kidded him about it.
Of course
you
not.
You never your credits that you once were a writer for Pat Boone, but he was. Anyway, we took our show, the Pat Boone Chevy Show, very adventurously to Europe. Nobody had ever taken a half-hour music variety show to Europe, but we went to Venice, Italy, to Paris, to Salzburg, Austria, and Rome. And we did our TV half-hour shows with European artists, mainly, and occasional American artists. When we were in Venice, there was a young girl. We were filming the gondolas, Shirley and I, riding along in the gondolas and the canals in Venice and performing. It was fantastic stuff for a half-hour music show. There was a young girl standing on the pavement watching us several days, and Shirley got to talk to her, and her name was Sharon Tate. And she was just the daughter of a military family stationed there. And she had stars in her eyes. She said, you know, I want to come to Hollywood. I want to be an actress. She was like 17, 18 years old. We actually featured her in one of the musical scenes, Feeding the Pigeons, on St. Mark's Square. And I did not do with her what I usually did for teenage girls who asked me about how they could become stars and actresses. My first advice was don't. Please don't even think about it, because acting, especially for girls, is a very treacherous minefield morally.
Some people don't know. I'll just say up front, she became a big star. She married Roman Polanski and was murdered by the Manson family in 1969. So you knew her when she was 17 years old. And obviously this is 1959, 1958, seven, something like that.
Yeah. So now she comes to Hollywood. We didn't know it. We saw her at a movie premiere of Giant, I think it was. And she waved at us and said, "Hey, Shirley, Pat, Sharon Tate, can we get together?" Oh, I said, "She's here? She made it to Hollywood?" Well, we never got together. I wanted to try to give her advice if I could, because I knew she was seeing her name now in roles, and she was dating Jay Sebring. I think they were the stylist, and now was involved with Roman Polanski. And then I opened the LA Times one morning, and there it splashed all over the front page, the Manson killings, including Sharon Tate, who was killed by two women and a man named Tex Watson from Denton, Texas, where I had gone to school, Tex Watson. And I always lamented that I never had took the chance to try to caution her and maybe help shield her. Her dreams came true, but her worst nightmares as well. Well, Tex Watson became a chaplain's assistant at the California Men's Colony, and I went up there with my musicians a few years later to perform for the prisoners, as I've done in a number of prisons. And sure enough, here's the chaplain's assistant, young Watson. Forget what his real first name is. It's not Tex. But anyway, he is the chaplain's assistant that gave me a Bible with his name inscribed along with the other chaplain group. And I performed and met the guy that unfortunately was the one who, high on drugs and Manson's demonic influence, killed her, Sharon Tate, the girl that I met.
But you mean to tell me that we're out of time, but did he came to faith after all of this stuff?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay. I wanted to end on a positive note. I almost failed, but I think I did. Pat, it's just so much fun and a privilege to speak with you. Thanks for being my guest.
Good to be with you, Eric.